Welcome to Q&A with TNK. They've surfed the interwebs. They've contemplated, ruminated, and speculated. They've checked the teletype, and now they're ready to answer your questions. Here are your hosts, Tiffany and Kristen.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Q&A with TNK. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Tiffany.
Hello.
Hello, and good morning.
Good morning. Okay, what accent was that?
I don't know. That's my... I woke up very recently and still have frogs in my throat.
And crusties in your eyes.
Yep. I'm a picture of beauty over here.
Oh, it's 7 a.m. in her world.
On and a Sunday.
Yeah, 9 a.m. in my world. She's very nice to get up early because I have 4 kids that have to get on with our day. So.
Yeah. And 7 is not that early.
No, it's really not.
I'm still sleeping in. Work is 5, so 7's like fine.
Oh, that's, yeah, totally sleeping in. All right, so what are we tackling today, Tiffany?
Today we have deviated from our usual setup, and Kristen and I decided that we talked about Free to Learn and the book, how impactful it is on your teaching practice, so much that today we're going to have a little discussion about the book. If you haven't read the book, pause it now, read it. It's a little bit bigger than our last pause and read situation.
Yes.
It's like 250 pages or so.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, 263 or so. Oh, that's the bibliography.
235.
At the back is humongous.
Yeah.
It's huge.
I want to dive into our discussion right now.
Okay.
One of my favorite things about this book is that it has a huge bibliography.
Oh, I know. I looked at it and I was like, oh my gosh. Like, how in the world does somebody find time to read all that? Like,
yeah.
It's like, how many pages long? I don't know. At least 20.
Wow.
20 pages. Yeah.
I'm flipping through it now.
Bibliography. So it's a very thoroughly well-written, like, well-researched book. Peter Gray is my idol now. Sorry, Jeff Johnson.
Yeah. Oh, I do love Peter Gray as well.
I do too.
The whole idea, I feel like it's so rare to read a book about education that is founded in well-researched anything.
Right.
And I read another book with a couple of my teacher friends recently called Fearless Teaching. And it mentioned that education as a science is only something like 200 years old.
Really?
And when you think about all the other sciences that have been around since like Leonardo da Vinci.
Right.
It really puts in perspective, like, there aren't a lot of books like this out there that anybody could just pick up and read about how people learn and about the history of education that are based in scientific research, because there's just not a lot of research out there. I mean, there is a lot of research, but it's also fresh.
Right. Exactly.
But it's changing constantly. And so it totally makes sense that there's this, you know, nobody knows, oh, should you teach kids uppercase or lowercase first? And it keeps waffling back and forth.
Right.
It's just because everything is so new.
Do you teach uppercase or lowercase first?
I do both. I mean, the curriculum that we use, which is another discussion about how I've broken up with it. Thanks, Jeff and Lisa, for giving me that term. I'm ready to break up with it. Other people are not, so I'm waiting for us to get to the point of breaking up.
Together.
But it's all lowercase. We're getting off topic.
Okay, we are. So, biggest takeaway from Free to Learn. What was your biggest takeaway, Tiffany?
My biggest takeaway was a quote. I'm going to read it. It's time to stop asking what's wrong with our children and start asking what's wrong with our system.
I love that.
That was huge for me.
Yeah.
Because it's always, everybody points fingers down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody points fingers upward anymore.
Right.
I think that's why teachers keep getting such a, I don't, do they get a bad rep anymore? I feel like teachers were held so responsible for things for a while, and that there's a pushback happening now.
Yeah, but I think that many people are starting to recognize, or do recognize, that teachers are doing the best that they can with what they're given, mm-hmm. and what they know, and what they're taught, and what they are seeing modeled. Mm-hmm. And they are, they're doing the best that they can. And teachers, I'm sure, are feeling somewhat trapped in the whole vicious cycle of standardized testing and, you know, the race to the top. And yeah. I think many people, and maybe it's just people who are studying how people learn. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just, because I know it, I feel like everybody knows it. you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I feel like people maybe are starting to understand that it's coming from the very top with policymakers and the government. And so it's the next episode, we're going to talk about how we as educators can change that and what we can do on a smaller scale. So, I don't know. I think people are starting to realize that, especially with all of the parents. And mm-hmm. this is not in Minnesota. I mean, people in Minnesota do not opt out yet of standardized tests, or don't mm-hmm. even really know that they can. It's my daughter, Sailor, last year in third grade, was the first year that she had to do a standardized test. The MCAs, they're called, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. And I was the only one in the school who has ever opted out. Mm-hmm. And they had no idea what to even, like, do with her during that time. Like, they had no clue how you could even opt out. The principal was, like, kind of astounded that it had happened. So, it's, I don't know, a trend I'm hoping to start maybe a little bit more of here.
Yeah.
I'm trying to educate people in our community that you can opt out. But
yeah.
I think, like, the East Coast, they're having large amounts of opt-outs of, mm-hmm. like, Common Core assessments. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a
feel like
wave
it's
happening.
A big wave over here, too, on the West Coast. Yeah.
So the Central, you know, really just needs to do some catching up.
But I think that speaks back to the looking at the system. We shouldn't have to be opting out. Policymakers should be designing systems that are good for children, that... and this also speaks back to the education being so new as a science. It's like nobody knows, or if they do know, they're not implementing it on a wide scale. How do you look at something like school quality in a different way besides just asking everyone the same exact questions?
Right.
There are other ways to assess how, quote unquote, good a school is. And is it even necessary? I mean, yes, it's necessary, right?
I don't know.
I feel like we're in this position, you and I are in this unique position where we have good schools. We are in a good school.
Right.
With your schools that you run. And
I
feel like I love my school. I'm at a good school where I work. I feel like it's a very different picture when you're in a quote-unquote bad school. That has staff turnover every year, that doesn't have any sense of school identity, that's maybe a poor school.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a whole other pod topic would be what would be our definition be of a good school versus a bad school?
Yeah. Better word choice might be our first.
Better word choice would be better there.
Yeah.
But I think that's a whole other thing, is how do you figure out what quantifies a good school?
Yeah.
Like, what makes a good school? What makes it developmentally appropriate? Like, who decides that?
Yeah.
That's a whole other can of worms, and it all goes back to the top.
Yeah.
Like, government. That's, we need to be, like, president.
I would vote for you over so many current candidates, Kristen.
So, your biggest takeaway Well, and you also had another driving question too about how do you read a book like this?
Yeah. That, you know, this book has been presented as like, oh, this will change your life. Everybody I know who read this book was just like, this is a life-changing book. It'll change how you do everything. So I was a little intimidated to start it.
Me too.
Because how do you read a book that's supposed to change your life?
I know. I was like seriously scared to read it. And I don't know if I talked about this. I might have in another pod, but I bought the book. Well, it's been about a year now, and it sat in my room on my dresser for till August. It sat there. So that was like 6 months ago. So it sat on my dresser for like 6 months before I cracked it open, because I knew that once I read it, I would be making big changes, and I was really scared of those big changes because I had already gone through huge changes with creating a program based on just the motivation after reading another book. I created a whole entire preschool program that was outdoor-based and nature-based, and had a fourth child in the process of getting that school open, and I had just finished the first year of preschool open that I was terrified to read it because I knew that it would send me on a whole nother journey, and I didn't know if I was ready for it. So when we were at UnCon, we were sitting across the table. I was sitting across from Lisa Murphy, and the book came up, Free to Learn came up, and Peter Gray came up, and I said, I have the book sitting here, and I haven't read it. I'm scared to death to read it. And she's like, pick it up and read it. Like, you need to read it. And I actually, like, my feelings got a little bit hurt because, you know, I had already done so much and I had spent so much time creating something else. And then I just didn't have time to read it. I didn't have time nor the energy to start a whole nother process. And so I actually, like, teared up when she was like, you need to find time to read that. Like, read it. And so when I got home, I was like, okay, I'm going to read this. And so I picked it up, and it was the summer on my deck, and I was reading or drinking a Corona while I started to read it. And I can't wait for the deck days again here. Oh, oh my gosh. I love summer and sun. So yeah, it's changed my life. It is a life, like, if you are a mover and a shaker and a doer, like I consider myself to be, it will change the way that you do things. So, but yeah, how do you, when you know that it's going to change you, how do you get the courage to pick it up and read it?
Yeah. And I think that that speaks to kind of the whole point of this book, is that so often in our educational system, we would just force you, like, hey, you're in a teaching program, read this book, it's going to change your life.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't make it impactful when you force somebody to read it. You have to have that motivation to do it.
To do it.
I think you just described the process of any child learning how to read, of like, I don't know if I'm ready to take this on. Sometimes you have to have somebody that says, like, hey, you can do it. You need to do this. It'll be great for you. And then you do it, and it's awesome. Like, that was a great example.
Exactly. Of how we learn.
How we learn, yeah.
We learn through wonder, and we learn through being curious is basically how we learn. We learn through curiosity and wonder. And, you know, I was curious, and so I picked it up and learned a lot.
Yeah.
And that's how all people learn. And that was my biggest takeaway, is that all people learn, not just kids. All people learn through play. Mm-hmm. And play can be defined as, I mean, Peter Gray described a few different kind of key things about what play is. I can't remember how many. I think there's 5 of them. Yeah. So play is self-chosen and self-directed. This is on page 140. If you're reading the book and following along, page 140, play is self-chosen and self-directed. Play is activity in which means are valued more than ends. So this is another huge takeaway that I kind of follow along with now too. Number 3, play has structure or rules that are not dictated by physical necessity but emanate from the minds of the players. 4 is play is imaginative. non-literal, and mentally removed in some way from real or serious life. And 5, play involves an active, alert, but non-stressed frame of mind.
Yeah, and then I see a 13, so I'm going to nerd alert.
Oh, yes. Go
back to notes on chapter, what chapter are we in here? 7. Because that sounds a lot like some, who is it, Stuart Brown does play stuff.
I don't know.
There are a lot of play. Vygotsky does play stuff. 6, 7. There's a 13. Wow. There's a big list. Brian Sutton Smith. Ooh. He's my next dream boat. Brian
really?
Sutton Smith. Yeah. He does awesome play research. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sources listed here.
So is it a culmination of all of those things that he kind of created these 5 definitions of play and what play includes?
Yeah.
So
another reason why I love Peter Gray. He did the work. He combined it all and like put it into perspective. I'm going to post these 5 sources.
So kind of the beginning of the book is all about a hunter-gatherer society and what we can learn from hunter-gatherer type societies. And so should I explain a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Like what that, so a hunter-gatherers, there's no formal schooling and there's still hunter-gatherer communities around the world. And I don't know if like he didn't go and actually like spend time with these people. Did he?
I don't know.
I don't think so. I think he took the...
He did some research.
Yeah. So, the children, they're free to play and explore all day long on their own. And how they play is by making their own little bows and arrows and kind of reenacting what they see their parents and elders doing. Mm-hmm. And they play games like that. And they pretend to cook with the little loose parts that they find around the jungle or forest floor or desert or wherever these hunter-gatherer cultures are.
And they turn gathering their food into a game.
Exactly. And that's, the kids are without adult interaction all day long, or adult guidance, I should say. They are on their own playing in mixed age groups. So it's 3-year-olds all the way through, I don't know, 15 or what, when, I don't know when they decide they're adults in hunter-gatherer communities, but...
Yeah, different in each one.
Yeah, so children are, they're free to play. They're free to take risks, and that's how they learn to get along in their society.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of the general gist of the hunter-gatherer cultures and what we can take away from that. The play is nature's way of ensuring that our children are learning the skills they need to grow up.
Mm-hmm. I love this part. I'm going to play the role of the stinker today. Why do you think hunter-gatherer was picked as the model? And not...
Boy.
Right? Like, is that like the most quote-unquote primal state of learning?
Living? Yeah. Well, I think... Schools are very much based on a factory model.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how our education system is now. And so I think maybe Peter Gray wanted to, like, take it back a step further. And what is the furthest from a factory model of education? And that would be formal education. And that would be hunter-gatherer societies.
Yeah.
Is there any other societies in the world that don't have formal education?
I don't know.
I mean, tribes in Africa, but would they be considered hunter-gatherer? I don't know.
Yeah.
We need to do some more research on this. Okay, yes.
If anyone is an expert.
Well, and he also, this. Peter Gray also, he refers to, like, studies on animals, too, on how... animals deprived of play in their adolescent or, you know, childhood of the animal's childhood and then introduced to animals later on in a playful situation, they react aggressively and scared and completely inappropriate for the situation. And so he kind of looked at, and that's probably the most primal about how you learn. If you're deprived of play, you don't develop in a normal fashion.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So with that, the book kind of also leads into that there's a huge increase in mental disorders in children now. That, like, I think he said that 5 to 8 times more children suffer from anxiety and depression since 1950 in current times. That's crazy.
That's crazy.
I've seen it, like, I see it firsthand. I mean, you've heard me talk about my son, Crew, and he's 8 and he's in 2nd grade. Mm-hmm. So this book is actually, it was like a huge life changer for me and him. I don't know, do you think this is a good time to talk about,
like, my whole story? A little lowdown, and we'll talk some more next episode too.
Okay, so Crew is, he has anxiety. He hasn't been diagnosed, but I can see the indicators of that. And in reading this book, I'm thinking, okay, so I read this and I read the part where that there's a rise in mental disorders in children. And I see it firsthand in him. When he was in kindergarten, it was heartbreaking. We went to his conference in November, and his teacher had pulled out a spelling test from October. He was in kindergarten. Spelling test, October, 6 weeks into the school year. Wow. He didn't even know all of his letters at that point in time. He had no idea that some letter, like what their sounds were that went with the letters yet. And
which is totally normal.
It's totally normal. So she had them take their spelling test. They had like a clipboard, and they'd go around, like sit somewhere in the room that was cozy for them. And she gave them a black felt tip marker. And the whole entire spelling test was like 10 words in kindergarten, 10 words. And we didn't know this was happening. She was just trying to see, I think, what sounds that could correlate with letters. I don't know. And so the whole class took the spelling test, and his was blank except for like number 6, and it had the word dog written in there, and the whole entire margins of the spelling test were like filled in with doodles, like just up and down lines, because he had no idea what to do. And right in front of him, she said, I think number 6 was taken from somebody else's spelling test. I was like, seriously, this is horrible. So I think that that was a huge part of, like, school anxiety for him. That was a huge starter for it. And after that, well, there's many other things. Like, they have to do testing. And so how they did testing in kindergarten so that the teacher didn't have to take time to do it is they hire or ask volunteers to come in and take children from their classroom where they're comfortable to a different room completely that they've never seen with an adult that they've never seen or met. And they are supposed to test with these kindergartners. And he refused to do it. He would sit there and not say anything the whole entire time. And then in his conference, the teacher would be like, he didn't talk to the test taker or the test giver. Well, yeah he's 5. He's 5, and you took him completely out of his environment. And so school for him has been a series of moments of anxiety. And there was a day in kindergarten, I remember very vividly, that he did not want to go to school. The bus came, and he wouldn't get on it, and he was bawling. So I put him in the car, and he opened up the car door while the car was running and was going to jump out of the car. This is a 5-year-old in kindergarten. Wow. And it's been like that ever since. And like this year, well, so we changed schools, thinking that maybe a smaller class size would be better. So now he's actually in a private school, 14 kids in his class. His teacher is amazing. Amazing. So wonderful. We're so thankful for her. But he still has anxiety over school. And there was one day I had to put him in the car in his underwear because he did not want to go to school. He refused to get dressed. I had to get to work. I have 4 kids. Like, we had to get them all in the car. It's like so stressful. And yeah. I had to put him in the car in his underwear and put three pairs of pants in there because he has sensory issues over what kind of pants he wears and with what shirt. And so I didn't know, like, it all stemmed from jeans that day. He like finds something like jeans that will be the trigger that sets him off for that day. And if he can't have the right pair of jeans on, if they're too short or too long, it will start this whole entire I'm not going to school thing. And he uses that kind of as his crutch. Like, maybe if I stress out enough about jeans, I don't have to go to school. And there was another day where he wouldn't buckle his seatbelt. We drove all the way to school with his seatbelt unbuckled. It's horrible. It's horrible when you have a child who does not want to go to school. So this book has caused me to think, okay, especially the part about how the rise in mental disorders in children and thinking, why am I doing this to him? And so we're trying to make changes. And so we've talked to him about an unschooling method. And so just him, and we're giving our other daughter who's in school right now the choice if she wants to unschool or not, but we're going to unschool next year, and we're just going to try to figure out a way to make it work because we both work full time. And I mean, that's a whole, probably another episode about how maybe we should interview somebody who unschools.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Anyway, I think, I don't know. Every child learns differently, and it's really hard when you deal with it firsthand, the anxiety and things that can happen when kids are uncomfortable in the school setting.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you love his current teacher. Mm-hmm. And I can't stress enough how much it's not the teachers. I mean, sometimes it is. Sometimes you get somebody who's like, whoa, we are not on the same page at all.
Exactly.
But most of the time it's, you know, the state of Oregon mandates that kindergartners take this entrance test.
Ugh.
That is terrible. I mean, it's getting better. Like, it's not timed anymore this year. That's the highlight.
Oh, my
gosh. They can take as long as they need to tell you how many letters they know. And it's like we've completely forgotten that kindergartners don't need to know letters. And, you know, that's also part of the assessment model that I disagree with. That, you know, it looks better for you as a school if kindergartners come in and they get every single one wrong. And then at the end of the year, they know them all.
Like, exactly.
That means you've done a great job teaching. What does that do to the child on the first week or second week or whenever you do that test?
Exactly.
That shows them that they don't know anything.
Right. Oh.
And I know that the people who administer the tests are very nice people who, you know, it's just 10 minutes of their life. It's just, but when you add all of that up, how much of their life is spent being told that, oh, you're just in kindergarten, you don't know anything yet. They know a lot of stuff. Ask them stuff that they do know. Every once in a while.
I like that. I agree with that. So, let's talk about Sudbury schools.
Yeah.
Because that's a huge part of the book. Peter Gray had a son who went to a Sudbury, Sudbury, a Sudbury school. Sudbury.
Yeah.
I talked to somebody on the East Coast that is the founder and director of a Sudbury school. And I asked, how do you pronounce it?
And what did she say?
It was a he, and he said Sudbury.
Sudbury? Okay.
Sudbury. Yeah. Anyway, when I was hoping to get out there and visit this Sudbury school, because there's not any close to me. There's some close to you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I know. You should go check it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I still need to come to Oregon, and we need to do a tour.
Yeah,
do a Q&A on the road with Q&A and with D&K.
A little road trip. I would love that. Love it.
That would be super fun. So Sudbury schools, it's a democratic model of schooling.
Yeah.
You explain a little bit, because I've talked a lot.
I want to talk about how much I love that he talked about Sudbury schools, because so often when you get talking about play-based and freedom-based education, it ends up being all about unschooling.
Yeah.
And I love unschooling. I think that's a great model for some families. But there is a privilege involved with unschooling, that you have that privilege.
Right.
Where you are... Oh, you're laughing at my cat.
Hi, Ace.
You're in a situation where, you know, you know a lot about education. You're well-informed. You're obviously motivated to learn. You know, you inherently model a process of learning that comes with privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what happens when I read idealistic education books, please don't step on anything important, Ace. What happens is that they completely ignore underprivileged families who rely on education as a means to get out of wherever they are.
Yes.
And this whole idea of a Sudbury school, it kind of meshes all of that together in my mind, where kids are taught how to be curious.
Yes.
Kids are taught, because it's a democratic school, you know, kids are on the board. Parents are on the board. Everybody is involved in the process of schooling, such that kids are taught how to make a difference.
Yes.
Kids are taught that they have a voice.
Yes.
And these are all things that I feel are completely lacking in education, especially, number one, especially in underprivileged schools.
So my question is, Sudbury schools are not free. Like, it's not public education. It's private education. And it's expensive.
Yeah. Was this the one where they talked about the Sudbury school costing half as much to run than a public school?
Really? I don't know.
I don't know if that was Peter Gray or if that was Fearless Teaching, Stuart Gower.
Does he talk about Sudbury schools in that book as well, Fearless Teaching?
I think it's Sudbury. It's definitely Democratic. It might be some
Democratic
hybrid.
Free. Okay.
I don't understand entirely how Sudbury and Democratic are separate. They seem very similar. It's like the same idea phrased differently.
Exactly. So, a Sudbury school is a type of Democratic school in that everybody has a vote, mm-hmm. even the five-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody, there's a school meeting at Sudbury schools where, is it once a week? I don't remember. I don't recall.
Yeah.
It's one a month or one a week. Where they vote on, it's like a school meeting and everybody has a vote. All of the teachers and all of the students have one vote on everything.
Yeah.
And the teachers are even like voted in or out. Survivor.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
I wish that parents and students had a voice in which teachers get to come back.
Yeah.
Because I think that it would make teachers really think about, I don't want to say the customer service of teaching, but it makes teachers think about how much people care.
Exactly.
You know? Right now it's like, well, I don't care if you like geometry. You have to learn it. Deal with it. You know? And
right.
I think that if teachers had that motivating piece that not necessarily people have to like them, but you have to be a good teacher to stay, I think that would solve some of those inherent issues with the system.
Right. What else about Sudbury? There's no teachers. It's kind of like guides, who advisors. I don't remember quite what they call them, but it's an adult who kind of helps children if they have an interest and they want to learn more. That person helps them figure out a plan of action to find out more about that topic, whether it's helping them find a community member who could help them learn more, or kind of give them ideas of tools that they can use to find out more about what they're interested in. Like, there's no children also at Sudbury schools. There's like no reading curriculum. It's, if you want to learn to read, I'll help you learn how to read.
Yeah.
And you just decide when you're ready to learn to read.
Yeah.
It'd be very interesting to go visit a school, because it gives me a sense of unease. Like, oh,
How do you
what
know?
If?
Yeah.
I know, but
but
I think
I think
that
it's that same thing that Lisa Murphy said to you. At a certain point, somebody's going to be like, you need to learn how to do this because look at all these things you could also be doing that you love.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. There might be some kids who need that little push. Mm-hmm. Like, let's.
But
yeah.
I don't believe that all children need that push.
No, they don't.
That's where, quote unquote, like the system. I feel like I get all punk rocky every once in a while. It's the system, man. It's forcing us all to learn how to read. Most of us will do it on our own. Some of us
right.
need extra guidelines.
Some of us, you know, probably don't even have the capabilities to be able to learn how to read until you're 9.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Everybody learns at a different pace, and, you know, there might be some 5-year-olds that are learning to read in a Sudbury school, and there might be some 13-year-olds that are just learning how to read.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Sudbury school is a very, very cool model of education. But I don't know if it's necessarily accessible to all children.
But that's, do you think that if we replaced the current public school model with Sudbury school model, would it work? I mean, money not being an issue.
Right.
If suddenly it was free for everybody to attend Sudbury schools. Do you think that that on a large scale would work?
I think that it would work if everybody who was a part of that school that was an adult was thoroughly and severely somehow like led to learn how and trust the process to learn how people learn through play. Mm-hmm. How if you're not, so my question is, if you're not curious about how people learn and you're not curious like about how play can be the way that people learn, are you ever going to trust it? If you're not,
yeah,
if it's
you're not,
it's
totally
not interested,
yeah,
interesting to you, you know. Mm-hmm. So, will it only work for the students whose parents and community get it?
Yeah,
oh, that's deep.
That is super deep. And I also wonder, what about the kids who the current system does work for?
Right.
There are so many people out there who just want to punch in, punch out, move on.
Right.
And is that okay? That is a legit work skill that a lot of people need to function in society.
But do you think maybe that they are like that because of how
their
they grew
school
up?
Experience.
Being, yeah. Like, maybe they were never given the chance to be wondrous and curious and think outside the box. And maybe that's why they just want to punch in or punch out.
Yeah.
Whoa. This is so...
This is so deep.
So philosophical. It's totally not me.
Because then okay. I like being the turd today. I'm just going to keep... I don't necessarily agree with this. But then I get back to the factory model of schools and how it's just, we're just producing factory workers. If we move in our, you know, alternate universe, if suddenly everyone is schooled in a Sudbury or Democratic school and taught how to be curious, who works in our factories? Who bags our groceries?
Oh, well, maybe they would be so, like, just... Maybe we'd be able at that point to have everything run by machine and computer that would have taken a factory worker, because we would have all of these innovative thinkers and they would be able to figure out a way to get those things done without the use of human brains on a day-to-day factory style basis.
Are we inventing new jobs for these millions of people?
I don't know. Whoa, this is like Twilight Zone style thinking here.
Yeah.
I don't know. It would be an interesting world, wouldn't it?
It would be.
I wonder, it would be really interesting to see what Peter Gray would have to say about this.
Oh, yeah. Peter Gray, what would our society look like?
Maybe, I wonder how we could get him to listen to this.
I'm going to link him on Facebook.
Okay. That's a great idea. Listen to
we'll
this
see.
And we have a question.
Yeah.
So we want to know, Peter Gray, what would happen if, what do you think would happen if we completely made all education a Sudbury style type of education for everybody and everybody believed in it? Mm-hmm. What would happen to our world?
I'm going to also plug Peter Gray's blog. Ooh, he's an excellent blogger. It's called Freedom to Learn is his blog. And it's through Psychology Today.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Follow him on Facebook. Everything he says is like, yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to like fist pump a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So, is there anything else, any other big things you wanted to mention about the book? Because in the next episode, we're going to kind of dive into what can we do on a smaller scale and maybe a larger scale to kind of, you know, envelop some of these and kind of, is that the right word?
Yeah. Yeah. I think before we leave, I don't feel like we talked about how do you read a nonfiction book like this? How did you read it? Talk me through the process.
How did I read it?
Yeah.
I picked it up and started it on the first page and read it till the end.
Page one. Go. That's your method. That's my
method.
That's my previous method.
Okay, so what's your new method? I need to know.
I feel like with nonfiction there's always a main point.
Okay.
And since reading this book, I got a lot out of it. I already want to reread it with a different lens. I used to read nonfiction books the same exact way I read fiction books.
Which
was like, what's the story arc? What's going on? Waiting till the end to like learn the twist. Where's the climax? But with a book like this, that's not the point.
Right.
So reading for story sometimes works with nonfiction. But I've since changed my methods about how I read or nonfiction books, especially teaching books. And I now have, I make a little page in the front.
Okay.
Either I write on the book itself or I get like a big sticky note.
Okay.
And I make two things to start and then I kind of go from there. I make one about the author.
Okay.
So like anytime the author tells me something that might change their view on the situation or that is unique to that author, I write it down. And then the other one is main points. What are they trying to say? How do they support it? What's the point?
Oh my gosh. I feel like, very organized.
I learned this method from my friend Anna. Hey, Anna in Seattle. But I feel like when you don't really look and assess what the main points are, you aren't able to think about, are they making that point successfully? Mm-hmm. You're only reading through and picking out the things that you're like, yes, I agree with that. Yeah. Or a very strong, no, I don't agree with that. No. And so just kind of keeping track of it, or at least thinking of it as you read along.
Right.
It changes fundamentally how you learn from nonfiction.
Good point.
So I had to throw that out there because the next book I read after this one, in which I started doing that, I retained so much more.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I might have to do that. Go back.
Yeah.
And reread.
That's
with
another
notes.
One on my list is revisiting books at different points. Like I'm ready to reread. It's Okay Not to Share.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it would be, I read it one of my first years in the preschool game, and I feel like reading it now, I would get very different things out of it.
Right, you totally would.
So understanding your personal biases is also important.
Definitely. Well, that's very much more than I thought about it. I just read it.
I just read it too. I'm just saying.
And I highlighted some things and like underlined and starred important things and flagged a bunch of pages.
That was my previous method. I've gotten really into like, how do you read nonfiction?
Because
I don't like nonfiction. I'm gonna go ahead and say it. I never read it on my own, unless it's about school for something that I really want to learn about. And I think it's just because I don't know how to read it.
Right.
I can read the words, but I don't read it the same way as I read a sweet sci-fi novel.
Right. I don't read sci-fi novels either. I'm reading The Land of Stories right now. Fantasy, that's what I like. Ooh. You know, Harry Potter and those are good. Yeah, The Land of Stories is fabulous. If you are, were you a Harry Potter fan?
Oh yeah.
Okay, you should read The Land of Stories. It's a good, it's like, you know, juvenile fiction.
Perfect.
But it's so good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what, my daughter and I are reading them together.
Oh,
she's
I love it.
10. Mm-hmm.
So you're a Harry Potter fan?
Yeah.
I just learned about the best Harry Potter podcast.
What?
It's called Witch Please.
Ooh.
And it's two, like, I think they're both PhD literature ladies, and they
really?
Like really talk about Harry Potter. It's excellent.
Oh, funny.
It's kind of girly, but like in all the right ways.
Cat, okay, are we ready for what would you do? Okay, what would you do? So you know that I don't know how many years down the road, but there's a one-way ticket to Mars.
One way.
You know that?
Okay.
Yeah. One way. You can't come back. But no. There's already people who are like, have you heard about this?
Yeah.
Okay, so people are like applying to go live on Mars when they get this little, you know, environment set up on Mars. They're going to send people there to live, but it's a one-way ticket because it takes like years to get there. Mm-hmm. Something insanely crazy like that. Mm-hmm. So you just go. You don't have any like ties back to your life.
Everything people, and everyone I love is dead.
No, they're not dead.
They're not dead.
No. No. Okay. So here's the like what would you do part.
Okay.
No. The what would you do part is if your friends and family could be guaranteed ultimate happiness and they wouldn't miss you because, I mean, that wouldn't be happiness then.
Yeah.
So they could have whatever would make them feel complete and happy, whether that be, I don't know what that would be. Some people that would be wealth. Some people that would be health. But whatever that would be to those people, they could be considered have ultimate happiness for the rest of their life.
Oh, wow.
And ultimate contentness for the rest of their life if you went to Mars and lived and never could come back. Would you do that? Would you take a one-way ticket to Mars for ultimate happiness for all of your friends and family?
Oh, that is a very hard question. I mentioned that, like, everyone I know is dead because I feel like that's the only way I would feel okay leaving. Like, my happiness would have to, like, everything I love and everyone I know would have to be dead for me to want to do that.
To do that.
But this flip side is a very good question. Everyone I know would be ultimately happy for the rest of their life.
If you are sacrificing your
life.
But who knows? Maybe you would find ultimate happiness on Mars. I mean, maybe you would find something there that would make you happy. I don't know. It would be a chance you'd have to take. Yeah. So what would you do?
Would you
live on Mars or not?
Well, I feel like I'd have to.
I know. Because otherwise everybody
so
would
happy.
Be.
Yeah.
But maybe they, what, like if they
that
never
might help
knew.
Me go.
Right. If they never knew you had to make this decision.
Okay.
So if they didn't have to know, would you go or not?
Oh, I'd like to say I would.
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't go.
I don't think so. Not if nobody knew it, that was the decision I had to make. But if everybody knew, like, Kristen's journey to Mars depends on my happiness for the rest of my life, I would have to go.
I don't know. I think I would go. This actually, the Mars trip, when we were in third grade, my amazing teacher, Janie, and she had a student teacher, but I guess she, Miss Day, I learned out later, she wasn't actually a student teacher. She was a friend who had finished teaching school and didn't have a job yet. And they set us up on a full project-based, we went to Mars.
Ooh.
And I was very into living on Mars for that whole year.
Really?
I feel like I have some background knowledge about what it's like to live on Mars.
Interesting.
It was so fun. I'll have to show you the book sometime. Each kid got, like, when it was done, they, like, cut everything up. So I have a little piece of the Mars planet. I have a little piece of the water system we developed. I have a little piece of the air filtration system. Like, we went to Mars. My. We lived on Mars. We grew food there.
So you remember that from third grade?
Yeah.
See, like, that was something you were interested in. You were wondering about, like, you learned. That learning.
I learned so much.
And we can talk about that in our next episode. So,
yeah.
Because that will tie in well with what can teachers do.
Yeah. I'm excited.
So, okay. Well, Tiffany.
Well, Kristen, it's been fun. See you next time on Q&A with
T&K. Woohoo!
This has been Q&A with T and K. Thank you for listening. From serious to silly, Tiffany and Kristen are eager to answer your questions. Just email them to q4tnk@gmail.com. That's q4tandk@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with another episode. Music by Kurt Pearsall. Tiffany's sweet, sweet hubby.
This has been an Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio production.